Hello and welcome to Rethinking Peace and Security, a podcast by Stop Fueling War, an association that focuses on security, the arms trade and peace. Normally our episodes are in French, but this is a one-off episode in English that is also available in French with dubbed sound. This podcast is a series of interviews with different activists, researchers and specialists on topics concerning weapons and our security. Holly and Alice, who work for Stop Fueling War, talk to these experts and question militarization with the help of our guests. In this episode, we interview Andrew Feinstein from Shadow World Investigations about corruption in the arms industry. Hi, Andrew. Thank you for joining us on our podcast. First of all, I'd like to ask you to introduce yourself, please, Andrew, and tell us a little bit about your background and what you're doing at the moment.
Sure. So first of all, thank you very much for having me on, and please forgive my lack of language skills. I am South African by background. I served as an ANC Member of Parliament under Nelson Mandela in our first democratic parliament. And I first came across corruption in the arms trade while a Member of Parliament. As the ranking ANC member on Parliament's Public Accounts Committee, I tried to investigate a very corrupt arms deal that my own government did and resigned from Parliament in protest when I was stopped from undertaking an unfettered investigation. This arms deal involved five European countries and companies, including France, and was really the point at which I believe the ANC lost its moral compass. That led me to write a number of books on the arms trade, including a book called After the Party, and then The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade, which was also made into a documentary feature film. And I serve as executive director of a London-based organization, not-for-profit organization, called Shadow World Investigations, which used to be known as Corruption Watch UK.
Thank you, Andrew. It's really great to hear about your background and the experience that you've had of corruption in arms deals in multiple countries. I mean, it's fascinating how it seems to be a pattern that happens everywhere, the same sort of things happening over and over again. So I was wondering if maybe you could tell us your definition of corruption. What do you think, what does it mean? And how do we link this to the arms trade in general?
I have a sort of a broad definition of corruption because I think when one is too specific, one sometimes excludes malfeasant or bad behavior. And we should be as inclusive of malfeasance as possible. So I describe corruption as the inappropriate use of public office for personal and or private gain. And how this relates to the arms trade is very simple, in that the arms trade, according to an extraordinary piece of work done by Joe Robo, who was at Transparency International at the time, accounts for around 40% of all corruption in all global trade. Now, initially, this just seems absurd because it's not that big a trade, but it accounts for such a huge percentage. And the reasons for that are very obvious and simple. One is you only have a small number of really big arms deals happening every year, and they're worth literally tens of billions of dollars each. So incredibly important to the buying and selling country and to all the intermediaries, the people in the middle. In addition to which, because these procurements or purchases are quite technical in nature, very few people are actually involved in deciding what equipment a country will buy and who they're going to buy it from. And then finally, and most crucially, everything that happens on an arms deal happens behind a veil of national security imposed secrecy, and therefore happens with what is almost legal impunity, so that corruption in the arms trade very seldom even gets investigated, let alone actually leading to charges and convictions. And it's this combination of factors that make the arms trade in particular such fertile ground for such massive corruption.
Thank you. So regarding those particular conditions, we were wondering if there are specific contexts where it can be fostered. You are talking about the national security frame that just prevents even the justice to actually investigate corruption when it's linked to arms trade. So I guess there are different contexts regarding countries. I know for some, you also have the secrecy for commercial contracts. So what are those conditions that can actually prevent corruption or foster it?
I think that in terms of the sort of conditions that create that fertile environment for corruption, there are a number of key things. The first is a very close relationship between weapons-making companies or defense companies and their governments. So in some countries, France, Italy, the state actually still has a stake, owns part of the company, the country's weapons makers. In other countries like the United Kingdom, where the state doesn't actually have a share in a company like BAE Systems or Rolls-Royce, the relationships are still incredibly close. And people move between politics, between the military, between government and these companies. And that creates a very fertile condition and environment for corruption as well, those sorts of relationships. I think in countries where there is a tendency towards secrecy and to protecting even its private companies, there is even more of a likelihood of corruption taking place. Then, in terms of the spying countries, I think where countries have little or very few checks and balances, where their state institutions are fairly autocratic, where the courts do not have any form of independence, both the rulers and private actors in those countries can get away with an enormous amount. So they also create a fertile environment for this sort of corruption. And of course, any form of secrecy around the military and defense. And this can range from a country like Saudi Arabia to China to Israel, where most of the defense spending is actually secret, is never made public in parliament or anything like that. What can you do? What conditions can you create to make it more difficult? First, I think in the selling countries, which are our countries like France, Germany, the UK, America, China, Russia, it is essential that we have a lot of parliamentary oversight over arms deals and arms exports, because in none of those countries do we have that in any meaningful way. Secondly, I think it's incredibly important to have in the public domain any sort of communication and links between government, the military, and companies, even if those companies are part or fully owned by the state. I think citizens need to demand that sort of transparency and accountability. That would make a very big difference. And then there needs to be far greater transparency around the use of intermediaries, what we sometimes call middlemen, arms dealers, arms brokers, arms agents, because it's estimated that about 84% of all corruption in arms deals goes through these intermediaries. And governments and companies often claim that they cannot answer questions or give any information about these intermediaries due to commercial confidentiality. But usually all these intermediaries are doing, paying out bribes, getting paid well for paying the bribes, and laundering the money to pay the bribes. So I think those three things are things that we can actively do to bring about less corruption in the arms trade that our countries are engaged in.
Thank you, Andrew. I mean, Alice and I were discussing this morning as well a case that's currently being investigated in France of corruption around the sale of Rafale to India, and how the investigation's been opened up in France. So, I mean, that's a good step forward in our opinion, that this is being investigated, but there's just so many examples of these sort of intermediaries and the different rules that apply to the arms trade, and how under so many different presidents, different corruption cases have come up in France. Yeah, and I was wondering, you know, what are your thoughts on this in France?
France is incredibly contradictory when it comes to corruption in the arms trade. There is no doubt in my mind, having investigated and written about the global arms trade for over 20 years now, that the relationship between politicians, their political parties, and corruption in arms trade is probably more profound in France than any other so-called Western country. The links are profound. And if one goes back to all post-war French presidents, and I would posit probably prime ministers as well, there are at least quite good allegations of corruption in an arms deal, if not proven allegations. And those are two different things, quite obviously. But the scandal of party political funding, individual politicians benefiting from arms deals, are probably more common in France than any other Western arms exporter. But at the same time, France is slightly better, and unfortunately, this is from a very low base, than, for instance, the United Kingdom, Germany, Spain, Italy, at actually holding people to legal account. So at least in the French situation, we did see the court case around the Angolagate scandal, which was the sale of weapons into the Angolan civil war, from which very prominent French politicians and political parties benefited. We have seen, for instance, in the case of Nicolas Sarkozy, some action being taken around the L'Affaire Pakistan. For every one of those that has been revealed and investigated in France, there are probably dozens that haven't, that I'm aware of, some of which I've written about. So France is slightly better than the others, but literally the others do virtually nothing at all. The problem with France is that even when the legal process takes its course, the outcome always seems to be in favor of the individuals, the political parties, and the defense companies, ultimately, even if there are initially guilty verdicts. And I have seen a situation with politicians, with the intermediaries, with companies being charged, being found guilty, and then the charges being reversed. But at least there are the trials. So France is better in that respect. I think France is remarkably secretive about its arms dealing. I think the French Parliament is extraordinarily remiss in the fact that it takes so little interest in France's arms exports, and secondly, in the corruption linked to them. And that is hardly surprising. When you have powerful party structures, like you do in France, even though I know before the last election, the party political terrain changed quite a bit. But when you have powerful parties with strong leaders, as you tend to do in presidential systems, parliaments, especially from members of those parties, tend to be very quiescent in wanting to deal with arms deals and corruption scandals. And I think that is the problem that France experiences at the moment. And there is not nearly enough transparency in its arms export controls, in what is made public, or in its party political financing.
Thank you very much for that. The following question would be, how can we tackle corruption? How can we actually make people accountable, even when there is a case and it goes on and it actually, the result is always the same. So what's the next step for us to actually have more control and accountability?
I think the key place to intervene in France is with the transparency, making public information, because this is about taxpayers' money. And I would argue that there need to be fundamental changes in France with the way in which arms export controls are practically enforced. Also, I think some of the laws are problematic and could be significantly strengthened, because at the moment, like many other countries, and I believe this is the case for the UK, Germany, Italy, Spain, and others, arms export controls are virtually voluntary because there are no consequences if a government doesn't follow them properly. But the reality is, as you say, the vast majority of French citizens have no idea what France's arms export controls are, let alone the consequences they cause. So I think transparency in parliament, in the media has a very important role to play, and civil society, organizations like your own. And this really, for me, is the heart of the matter. And I think when you said, you know, it's very difficult for people to follow these cases. It's very difficult to get people interested in this. There was a poll, I was doing some talks in Germany a few years ago, and a poll was taken that showed that German arms trade corruption, which is also rife, is a concern to, I think it was 73% of German citizens. But for that 73% of German citizens, it was between their 11th and 17th most important issue. So it didn't matter that they were concerned about it because it just wasn't a priority for them. And I think it's our responsibility as civil society to actually raise the pressure on our elected representatives and on our state prosecutors. And the way in which we do that is to communicate information about the reality of the global arms trade in accessible, easy, entertaining ways for ordinary people to be able to understand and access. You know, I think if the majority of French citizens were aware that French weaponry that is sold in their name using their tax euros was being used in the committing of war crimes in Yemen through the intentional targeting of innocent Yemeni civilians by the Saudi UAE-led coalition that UN expert panels have identified as war crimes. If the French, first of all, saw the reality of that and understood the link to them, that their money is being used for this, I think that the reaction would be different. I think the second thing is the understanding that this is costing ordinary French people euros and cents in every day of their lives. So what do I mean by that? Well, when billions of euros get used as subsidies to French arms companies, because none of these companies make a profit if they weren't getting such huge government subsidies for their research and development, for their export promotion, for the role of French embassies in the sales, et cetera, et cetera. And that all costs us, the taxpayer, money. And I think if we made explicit how much money was being wasted and made clear to French people what are called the socioeconomic opportunity costs of that money. So in other words, what they are not getting because all that money is being spent on these weapons. Do all French citizens feel that the government's response to the COVID-19 vaccine doesn't require any more money? Do they feel that education in France doesn't require any more money? Do they feel that the infrastructure in France, the public infrastructure, public transport, bridges, roads, railways, are all perfect and don't require any further investment? Because of course they don't. And if they understood that the reason that these areas are being underinvested in is because of the massive spending of money on these weapons companies and on the making of the weapons, I think it then becomes easier to have conversations around them. And the important point to make is, you know, when a French politician is receiving a bribe, when a French political party is getting donations from an arms deal bribe, that is French taxpayers' money that's being used for that bribe, because this is money that should be paid by the buying country to France, but a huge percentage of that money that France earns goes in bribes, both to the selling country, which is France, the people who enable the bribes to be paid, and in the buying country, to the politicians who make the decisions. We produced a book called Indefensible, Seven Myths That Sustain the Global Arms Trade. That is really, and it's available for free online at a site called projectindefensible.org. And it's really an attempt to help people have these conversations about what the arms trade really does and how it not only makes them poorer, not only undermines their democracies and the rule of law, but the most important thing of all, makes them less safe. Because the reality is France buys its own military equipment depending on the bribes available. So it doesn't buy the best equipment that's needed to protect France. It buys the best equipment that has the biggest bribes. So we don't even buy the right equipment to defend our own citizens. We sell weapons to the people who are the ideological supporters of, the financiers of, and often the people who provide weapons to the supposed Islamist extremists we're involved in a perpetual war on terror against, because that's Saudi Arabia. So if these sorts of things were pointed out to people in accessible ways, and I think here we, as campaigners, have a responsibility to use as many media as we can. Social media is very important. Talking to people is very important. Film is very important. Short film clips, just putting bits of useful information into people's hands, because it's only when French voters start to put pressure on politicians and say, well, actually, you know, I'm not going to vote for you unless you take a stand on this issue. Or, you know what? I'm only going to pay 70% of what I owe in tax, because 30% of it is going to pay you and Saudi Arabian royal princes bribes on weapons that France is selling to them. I think that is the way we break through the conversation, because it's only by putting pressure on the political elite that we're going to see the checks and balances that we want. And then finally, very quickly, to say that I do think that strategic litigation using the law remains a very, very important tool. So I think those are some of the ways in which we try and make the conversation one that many more people can participate in.
Thank you very much. I definitely agree with you. So I think it was very interesting what you say, that we should have this double strategy of a legal framework on one side, which has been started actually very recently in France about corruption. We don't have that many legal tools. And on the other side, political costs in France about corruption are very low compared to what we could actually achieve. So hopefully this is the good track.
Yes, thank you. So you wrote this amazing book, Shadow World Investigations, about the global arms trade. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about, you know, do you see these patterns everywhere? Is it the same thing everywhere?
So the incredible thing is there is no doubt that there is a sort of a global systemic nature to arms trade corruption, be it in the United States, where it's a form of what I call legalized bribery. Because you can pay a politician huge amounts of money towards their campaign and then demand that they give you back multi-billion dollar projects. And that's almost accepted, and it's all above board and we can track it. In Western Europe, in France, in the United Kingdom, it is illegal. The problem is it doesn't get prosecuted. Of course, in every country, there are idiosyncrasies, there are differences. And one needs to understand the uniqueness and the characteristics of that country. So I can't talk about the German arms trade and the French arms trade as though they're identical, but there are certain elements of them that are the same. The involvement of politicians, the funding of political parties, the misuse of arms export controls, the violations of the EU common position on arms exports, of the International Arms Trade Treaty. What is also common is this linkage between the natural resources sector and the arms trade. Joe Robo, who I mentioned earlier, who came up with a 40% figure, was actually an intermediary in the oil industry. And having made so much money, he left the industry very early. And having seen how deeply corrupt it was, he decided, he went to Transparency International to start investigating corruption in the oil trade. But what he found was an enormous amount of the corruption in the oil trade was actually located in the arms deals linked to oil deals. And often the payment for arms deals is in oil, especially from countries like Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, et cetera, et cetera. So that linkage is profound. In addition to which, we see in conflict zones like the Democratic Republic of Congo, we see arms dealers often working on behalf of very senior politicians who will exchange weapons, not just with the government, but with the various assorted militia in exchange for mining concessions. So this manifests in all sorts of different ways, but that linkage is incredibly important at all. And what underpins this entire edifice systemically is the secrecy and this incestuous relationship between the political process, the state in its very broadest sense, and these private companies, defense companies and oil companies that are almost regarded as national treasures because we need oil and we need to be safe. And this is how our governments close down these conversations. So one of the primary reasons, to go back to Alice's earlier question, one of the primary reasons that people don't think too much about their country's arms trade is because our political leaders tell us we've got to spend all of these billions because it's keeping us safer from all of these threats. When we then examine the threats, we realize that the vast majority of those threats are manufactured or are blown out of all proportion. So we have a situation, for instance, in the UK, and I'm sure it was not dissimilar in France, where as the COVID-19 pandemic started in this country, when we didn't even have enough gloves and face masks for our frontline health workers, we increased our defense budget by £17 billion. Now, clearly, a far greater threat to us than Islamist fundamentalism, however it's defined at that particular point in time. And I'm very wary of these terms because I worked for a man, Nelson Mandela, who Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and others described as a terrorist. So I am very cautious about the use of all of these words. But the reality is health pandemics, the climate crisis, are far greater immediate and long-term threats to us as human beings. But we invest these billions and billions and billions in this trade in weapons. So it's also a matter of breaking through the accepted systemic political narrative of, first of all, making us incredibly fearful on the one hand, and on the other hand, actually being realistic about what the threats are to what is often called our human security.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because we've been working on an exhibition recently, which will be showing in Paris on the 7th to the 10th of October, called Sans Armes Citoyens, which is a play on words on the Marseillaise, which is Aux Armes Citoyens. We were having this exhibition, and one of the things that we want to demonstrate is this sort of very limited definition of security that the state uses, and the sort of very militarized security perspective. And one of the things we're trying to do as an organization is expand the definition of security, make it mean human security, bring the people back to the center of the discourse. And that means, you know, healthcare, all these things that you've mentioned, these are all relating to our security. It's interesting that you bring that up.
First of all, it's great to hear about the exhibition, and hopefully by then we're able to travel. We are not just arms trade campaigners. We are human campaigners. We have a responsibility to be concerned about the climate crisis. We have a responsibility to be concerned about global health pandemics. We have a responsibility to be concerned about inequality in our own countries, in our own regions, and globally. And the arms trade insinuates itself into all of these sorts of things because of the amount of money it wastes, because of the amount of pollution it produces, the amount of human displacement and suffering that it causes. I mean, Yemen is the greatest human catastrophe we've seen in decades on the planet, and that has been caused by French, British, and American weapons, primarily. So we have to understand this campaigning and this activism as crossing all of these boundaries and looking at what underpins it, which are our deeply distorted systems of economics on the one hand and politics on the other. And of course, they hold hands very comfortably to serve the interests of a very tiny minority of very powerful and very wealthy people at the expense of the vast majority of people.
Completely agree. And the arms trade is always the exception to the rules in every way. Like in trade rules, they're the only ones. It's the only industry that can use offsets, isn't it?
Absolutely. But we can't even ask these questions because they're matters of national security. So you're quite correct. The World Trade Organization bans the use of offsets, which are economic nonsense. They're basically an undertaking that we will invest, if you buy $100 or euros of our weapons, we'll invest 120 or 150 or 200 euros in your economy. They're never delivered, except occasionally in the United States of America and India, interestingly, but they're always used by politicians to justify massive arms deals that are unjustifiable in any meaningful terms. So the WTO has seen the problem of offsets in every sector and bans them as a criteria for making decisions about public purchasing or procurements, with the exception of the defense sector. And why is that so important? Because offsets are the primary means that intermediaries use for corruption in the arms trade. And so we're now engaged in a process where we've done some research and we're starting to engage with the WTO about changing that exemption. But this notion of a national security exemption, of course, there are certain things that shouldn't be in the public domain. I mean, I would love a world without war, but that's not what we have at the moment. So there are certain things that we can understand are kept secret, but there are a tiny amount of things that need to be kept secret. Instead, what is happening is that our governments and our companies are keeping secret what is often criminal behavior that they should be prosecuted for. And that's one of the reasons why they're keeping it secret and why they cover it up for so long. So it's for this reason that we mustn't let those in power hide behind this national security veil.
I think this is going to be the perfect way to end our questions. And what we want to offer is a reflection on how can you live in a peaceful society? So how can we deal with corruption to make the society more peaceful and to make people actually safe? So we probably cannot get rid of corruption in the next weeks, but how can we think a better society that will actually make people safe while we have this corruption issue?
The starting point is the understanding that we are active citizens. In our liberal democracies, where we're lucky enough to live in them, we've become far too passive. We think if we vote every 4 or 5 years, we're engaged politically. We're not. And as a consequence of which, we have seen the political discourse, we have seen politics dive deeper and deeper into the gutter. We have seen the rise of the far right wing. We have seen the far right wing occupy the Oval Office in Washington, D.C. We see the far right wing occupy 10 Downing Street. We see in France someone who describes himself as a centrist, someone who was engaged in politics from the age of 12 and has been a formal politician. So I think we have to take back control of our lives. We have to remember that the people who sit in parliament, the people we elect to regional offices, they are there to represent us. And if they don't represent us in making our society a safer, peaceful, healthier, more just and more equal society, we must withdraw our support from them. And we can do this in multiple ways. Obviously, by not voting for them, by perhaps ourselves putting up political candidates who envisage a different type of world. Of even going so far as some war veterans in the United States have done, where they calculate 30 cents on every dollar they pay in tax goes to the US war machine. So they only pay 70% of their tax obligation, and the tax authorities don't know what to do with them. They've been doing it for years and years now because they will not fund the American war machine. So we can even think about such extreme measures as that. We have seen the impact that climate activists have had on actually closing down parts of our economy driven by fossil fuels. And I think we need to learn from that, and we need to work together on those sorts of things. But how can we live in a peaceful society? We've got to re-educate ourselves. And we have the ability and power to do that as human beings. I'm a great believer in the competence and ability of each and every human being if given the opportunity. You know, in France, your political leaders told you that by being part of the NATO bombing missions that bombed Libya, you were making France safer. Well, actually, that wasn't the case, because the first thing the NATO bombers had to bomb were the anti-aircraft missiles that France and others had sold to Muammar Gaddafi when he was brutally ruling Libya. And the bombing of that stuff and the then support of Libya's overthrow has actually made the country and the region far less stable and has made it more likely that people right on the fringe of society are going to take action against ordinary, innocent French citizens. We are creating those conditions, but then our politicians stand up and point the finger at everyone else but themselves. We have to take their fingers and point them back where they need to point, which is at the politicians themselves. And ask them where the real danger to our security lies. And at the moment, I would suggest that by investing more in actually fighting climate, which could end human life as we know it, but I know might affect the business friends of President Macron, we will be doing far more to ensure our security and safety going forward than selling weapons to every non-democratic, autocratic, aggressive regime around the world, which is what France does at the moment and has done for decades and decades. That by actually putting enough money into public health research and into preventative measures to prevent pandemic spreading, as we've seen COVID-19 spread, that will make us far safer than spending another 10 billion euros on the latest jet fighter that French companies have produced. Because the reality is France is not going to be at war with anyone for generations and generations to come, where jet fighters are going to be of any use whatsoever. That's not how war is fought anymore, even if there was somebody who wanted to start a war against France. And if there is, I'm not aware of who that country or people are. So I think it's a matter of reorienting how we understand the world. And I'll give you one statistic, and it might be useful for you to try and generate a similar statistic in France. In the United States of America, and this is in the Indefensible book that I mentioned at the website projectindefensible.org. In the book, we cite a study that showed that at the height of the war on terror rhetoric, 43% of Americans believed that a member of their immediate family, so wife or husband, children, were likely to be killed in a terrorist attack in the next 12 months. Now, the reality is, it is far, far more likely that an American will be killed by a toddler of 5 years or younger using their own weapon in their own house than by any form of terrorism, be it white supremacist right-wing terrorism, or be it Islamist extremism, so-called terrorism. But almost half of Americans live in constant fear that they or someone close to them is going to be killed by some form of foreign terrorist. Now, it would be very interesting to know what the similar statistics in France are about likely causes of death and where we therefore invest our money. Because unfortunately, there is in France, just like there is throughout the world, there is what is called a national security elite, made up of very senior politicians, especially of the defense and intelligence portfolios, the heads of the intelligence agencies, the heads of the military wings, and of course the defense companies. And they all benefit materially from provoking this fear. Because the reality is, we actually achieve far greater safety by negotiating and by investing in peace and by investing in our broadest possible human security. But you know, I must just tell you in conclusion that sometimes doing the work that you do, what some people have referred to as the work of angels, can be very frustrating. And you feel sometimes as though you're bashing your head against a brick wall. But in the over 20 years that I've been doing this work, in France, across Europe, in the United Kingdom, in the United States of America, even in China and Russia, I have seen far more spoken about and written about the arms trade, about what real security is, in the last 6 or 7 years than I saw in the 13 or 14 years before that. And that has to be a positive. And we will reach that tipping point when the majority of people realize how absurd our expenditure on war and conflict is by comparison to the real threats that we face. So we've got to keep on putting information into the public domain. We've got to keep on using art exhibitions, films, social media, books, cartoons, whatever we can to continue to educate people about the reality of the world in which we live. And to that end, let me say that I will come and show the Shadow World film in various parts of France, just like we've done in the United Kingdom. I've traveled over 20,000 miles in the United Kingdom, showing the film to tens of thousands of people. Because like in France, the film was never broadcast in the United Kingdom. And even worse, France is one of the very few countries in the world where the Shadow World book has never been translated. And the only way you do that is by getting out and communicating with ordinary French citizens and reminding them in France, of all places, given its political history, that to be a citizen is to play an active role in creating the community, the country, and the world that you want to see. So we should also not forget, when thinking about the pervasive fear and anxiety we have in our societies, about threats that are actually infinitesimal in likelihood, that our mainstream media, the main sources of our information over the past few years, have let us down very badly. They're not providing any sort of balance in the information that we get. The coverage about conflict, about our heroes, about why we need weapons, about why we need to sell weapons, to me is covered so often without a word of criticism, without a word of thought or insight. And the reason for that, unfortunately, is very simple. Many of the big media houses in France, like in the rest of the world, are owned by the very same economic and political interests that own the defense companies, that benefit from a climate of fear, that maybe don't see the benefit in a more just, a more equal, a more climate-friendly, and a healthier France. Because at the moment, they benefit materially from the way the country exists and how it conducts itself globally. So I think we as civil society have to take up the role of the established media. And we need to use social media, but we need to use it in an informed and fact-based manner so that we can actually differentiate ourselves from a lot of the nonsense that sometimes appears on social media about some of these issues. And in that way, we create a more informed, a more educated, and often a healthier and safer citizenry.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Rethinking Peace and Security. We hope you found it informative. Find us on social networks at Stop Fueling War on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. Thank you. Bye.